Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic. One more race to go in 2022. MotoGP's 20 Grand Prix season is coming to a close this weekend at Valencia with a title showdown between Pecco Bagnaia and Fabio Quartararo. It will be Ducati versus Yamaha. But the gap is big for leader Bagnaia. He's got a 23-point buffer, making it as good as his championship. For Quartararo, has to win it, and Bagnaia has to be just inside the top 15 with 15th position. Pretty well a given for the Italian. But you only add up the points at one point in the season, and that will be at about 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon after the Valencian Grand Prix. Simon Patterson, Valentin Hurunci, they join me, Toby Moody, as we look forward to the weekend in Valencia. But a quick thank you once more to Matt Beer for being the super sub whilst I've been away on a couple of rally raids. Gentlemen, much talk has been given to the season finales in 500 and MotoGP in the past, but in my eyes, never like this. And yet, it's really only a glimmer of hope that Quartararo has. If we look back to 2017, Marquez was leading Dovizioso by 21 points, but he never had, Dovizioso never had this amount of the underdog can do it talk. Is this different, Val?
No. Not really. No, this is Dovizioso 17 again. Maybe with a slightly better rider, with a slightly better package, I want to say, but it's a tough one really. It is basically just the same thing, I think. Especially because we've seen a propensity from Fabio to push over the limits and crash as he desperately tried to salvage his title bid. As a reminder of 2017 to our listeners, Dovi needed to win in Valencia. Mark Marquez basically needed to non-score. Marquez nearly held up his end of the bargain. He was running ahead of Dovizioso and I think tucked the front and had to pick himself up and rejoined back in fifth, potentially offering a glimmer of, oh, this is possible. He might crash because he's Mark, and Mark just sometimes does things. But then a few laps after that, Dovi, I think running third, and an increasingly distant third, shortly after his teammate Jorge Lorenzo crashed, Dovi also crashed because it wasn't a race for the Ducati to win, and whatever Marc Marquez did was never going to change that. And there's a real risk that Valencia 2022 is going to be the same.
Yeah, I think the reason that there's a glimmer of hope is maybe because of 2017 and because of how manic that race was, and the fact that one of the guys did crash, the other did crash but managed to stay on the motorbike in the way that only Mark Marquez can. So I think maybe that's the reason why there's that glimmer of hope, because anything can happen. And arguably because while he's done a lot this year, an awful lot, to shift that reputation that Bagnaia has of someone who can sort of fumble the ball occasionally, there's still, you'd still say there's more chance of that happening than there was of Mark Marquez doing it, because that season, you know, he was strong all year. He doesn't make that many mistakes in races, despite the amount of crashing he does in practice and qualifying. So I think maybe it's the combination of those factors that's given a glimmer of hope, but it's a big ask. Like, there's no two ways around it. Valencia, a few years ago, you would have said there was an average chance, maybe, because Valencia was a circuit where the Yamaha was super, super fast in the days of you know, Jorge Lorenzo's basically untouchable final Yamaha victory in 2016, where just, you know, no one was going to stop him that weekend. But it does look like the balance has shifted back towards Ducati in the last few races. And they've been very, very strong at a circuit that traditionally hasn't been that good for them. And yeah, that really all adds up to make it the very faintest of glimmers for me for Quartararo.
Maybe all us journalists, we only talk about, oh, well, Valencia could be the wild card, because we get there in the dark, we leave in the dark, it's cold and it's just not a normal sunny, I'm not saying a Mugello 32 degrees sunshine all week, it's just not right for a Grand Prix.
It's not European MotoGP weather conditions.
It's just not right for a Grand Prix, is it? It's the right place, it's the right country, it's just the wrong time.
Yeah, it's a strange race. And if you were to look at Fabio's record at Valencia specifically, he was really good on his debut in 19. It was on pole, and he ran Mark reasonably close for much of the race. And that was, of course, Mark's legend season. Then he was no good there in 20, but Franco Morbidelli was good there in the 19 Yamaha that year, obviously just making it extremely obvious that the 19 Yamaha was a really good bike, and the Yamaha since have not been as good. And last year, Fabio was just no match for the Ducati. So I'm not sure there's any good reason to believe that suddenly this Yamaha package will stack up better against this Ducati package at Valencia. Ducati was already 1-2-3 in qualifying, 1-2-3 in the race there last year. Fabio already had virtually no chance at winning there last year. I don't really see how he wins a straight fight against the Ducatis. And there's four principal Ducatis he has to outfox, definitely, who all have a real good shot at victory. One of them is, of course, Bagnaia, but then you have Jorge Martin, you have Enea Bastianini, you have Jack Miller, who all of whom you would expect at the sharp end there.
Well, more so Martin after Malaysia. I mean, he's got a score to settle with himself.
Yeah. All four need to falter in some way, which that's a lot. You're asking for a lot. You're asking for like a big, big, big debt to call in from all of them. And that's not a thing.
And here's the thing. Bagnaia essentially needs to finish in the points to win the championship, regardless of Quartararo does. And unless, you know, say he has a shocker, say he falls off, then there will be probably six other Ducatis in the points ahead of him at that point who will be realistically expected to pull over and let him through. And we haven't had the obvious team orders. You know, we've had lots of talk about team orders, but we haven't had obvious team orders. But, you know, that is maybe the one point in the season where they could realistically be brought into play.
It is the nightmare scenario for Ducati and MotoGP. That is the worst possible way that this title fight, you know, injuries aside, the worst possible way this title fight could end is if Quartararo was somehow leading, the Ducatis were somehow, you know, in the points, and Bagnaia going from 20th after crashing and just watching them one by one pull over to the side of the road to ensure he scores the points he needs to score. Just imagining that, just saying that out loud, it sounds like one of the grossest things you can absolutely imagine. But I think MotoGP is very lucky that it looks distinctly unlikely.
I think the situation, if it's raining or it's that 50-50 drizzle at 1:45, race starts at top of the hour, I wouldn't want to be any of the riders or any of the team managers at that hour. I mean, the only thing that Yamaha can do is really baby Quartararo through Friday, through Saturday, because we have to remind ourselves he's still got that injured finger. It's still a mess, and it's still, looking back on it, a week and a bit after his Malaysian ride, what a ride he did to get on the podium with a mashed finger that he stuffed into an ice pack immediately in Parc Fermé. But come Sunday in Valencia, if the weather is bad, the only thing that Works Factory Yamaha can do with Quartararo is do exactly the opposite to what Works Factory Ducati do with Bagnaia. That's their only punt.
I don't even know if it'll go as far as Sunday, because I think, like last weekend, we knew on Saturday that Quartararo wasn't going to win in Sepang on Saturday afternoon. And I think we'll know again this year. If Quartararo qualifies seventh in the grid, then it's game over. That's just, nothing else is going to change that. Unless it goes to something bizarre like a flag to flag or, you know, but in normal conditions, can't see him coming back from anything less than a front row start.
A flag to flag, which Fabio will not win, because that's,
well,
not,
there is that.
That's not his forte, really.
I'll tell you what, I hope we listen back to this in a week's time and we are all completely wrong. That'll be just fantastic. Brilliant. Just coming back to what you said about Dovizioso 2017, Val. I seem to remember when he did bin it, he stood up and kind of went, oh, well, I gave it a go. Shrugged his shoulders. Oh, well, I knew I wasn't going to win it. I gave it all I got. I ended up in the gravel. Let's all go to the match.
And was waiting for Marquez to give him a hug in pit lane when he rolled through at the end of the race.
There you go.
Which again, it is the likeliest outcome for Fabio. It is the easiest outcome to imagine. Either him finishing like a heroic third or fourth, or crashing out and going, did what I could. What can you do? I've gone through the results a bit of the three main classes, actually, because why the hell not? And maybe I'm bad at this, so there's every chance I miss something, but you have to go really far back to see somebody overturn a double-digit points lead in the final race. Like, I had to go back to 1993 in 125cc, best friends Loris Capirossi and Tetsuya Harada. Yeah, obviously, before the crash, 5 years before the famous crash. But yeah, Capirossi went in with a 10-point lead. Harada won the race. Capirossi struggled with the tires, let the championship slip away. And after that, there's just been this really steady and relentless march of riders showing up to season finales with a decent lead and usually just finishing where they need to finish. And just, you know, just doing the absolute minimum. Or not the absolute minimum, because it's still hard work, but doing what had to be done. So you go Rowdies in 93, Zaccata in 98, Poggiali 2001, Tom Luthi 2005, even Marc Marquez in a sense 2010, that's all 125cc. Alex Marquez in 14, kind of, but he was under a bit of pressure. Danny Kent 15, Simon will remember that probably. Albert Arenas, although it was kind of a hard one in 2020. And more recently in the intermediate class, we've seen Hiroshi Aoyama secure the title over Marco Simoncelli with relative comfort just by finishing seventh. We've seen Bastianini do what needs to be done in 20. And we've seen Remy Gardner basically cruise last year.
Didn't Vinales win it last corner at Moto3?
Yes, but that was he was trailing by 2 points coming into the finale.
Not double digits.
Luis Salom was already out of the picture. So yeah, it's, points leads have changed hands in season finales, but when there's this big a margin, riders seem to know what they need to do and know what they can get away with. Like we've not really seen a disaster of, you know, well, obviously there is one example, which is not a double digit points lead, which we'll get to right now. So yeah.
Well, the 2006 finale was 8 points with Valentino leading ahead of Nicky Hayden. Nicky, he made a great start from the second row. I'm tingling already. He just got a perfect start at the end of a season in which he was struggling with his starts because he had a different clutch in that bike compared with the other V5 Hondas. And he just barged through two people in front of him on the front row of the grid, down to the first corner. He was second or third at the first corner. Brilliant start. Valentino struggled and, of course, eventually dropped it at that second corner, the difficult corner. Why is it difficult? Well, it's cold in November in Europe. We've touched on that already. It wasn't a good place to be. Interesting reading an article, though, from Lynn Jarvis the other day, and he said, well, maybe Valentino came into that race looking back on it with hindsight, that he wasn't on the front foot. He was a bit more relaxed as we look back on it all these years later. It'd be interesting to get inside the mind of Fabio Quartararo. You know, oh dear, have I got to do it again? Have I got to go out? Am I going to knacker my finger up? Why don't I just go and get the surgery done? You know, all these thoughts ebb into one's minds, I'm sure, as a racer. But back in 2006, Nicky was like, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to try. I'm going to fight. I got knocked off at the last race by my teammate. Danny did kind of fist pump him in the garage before they went on the outlap to the grid to say, sorry, mate, I'll help you out. There was a bit of footage and he let him through, but it was the aggressiveness of Puig and Pedrosa after Estoril was, well, technically I could have won the championship going into Estoril. Yeah, mate, but you had a 47 or something ridiculous point gap that you were going to struggle to overturn.
Don't say that size of a point gap is impossible to overturn. Yeah. It'll make Fabio sad.
Well, it was, yeah, one race to do a big points turnaround, but two, yeah, and in the same team, and the aggressiveness on that Sunday night in Estoril was not. It was one of those times, Simon, when the journalists were right. But you know, in the end, you know, Nicky turned it around. I actually sent him an email. I think I printed it out. I don't know where it is, but it was just like, mate, just stick in there. And he wrote back like, I'm going to give it everything. And we all saw the emotion on the cooling down lap. One of the best days I'll ever have at a Grand Prix circuit. The two of them on the bounce, they were just incredible places to be. But 2006 was just an 8-point gap between Valentino and Nicky Hayden. Not what we're talking about with 23 come Sunday.
I can see why Lynn Jarvis brought it up as a sort of reference point for Yamaha. Everything is possible. And I don't know if you're speaking about Rossi being relaxed or the team being relaxed or just the general impression.
Rossi.
All right. But I don't think that made the difference. Just looking back at that race, and it is unimaginable for a similar set of circumstances to finish, to happen in Valencia. And let me explain what I mean by that. Bunny, I can crash. Rossi, not exactly known for crashes. Just revisiting that weekend, I listened to quotes from Hayden, and he said things like, Valentino, last time I checked, he's not exactly a choke artist or anything. And
brilliant.
The truth is, Rossi just got to go follow me in Valencia. The dude just got to go follow me. So he was...
Sounds like Nicky.
Maybe piling the pressure on a bit, maybe just honestly saying what he meant, because that was it was a reasonable stance to take. But already at the moment that Valentino Rossi crashed in that race, he was in the position to lose the championship. Doesn't necessarily mean that he was on course to lose it, but in the points as they ran, he was losing. The 8-point gap was gone. Nicky was second, Rossi was seventh, I think, and staring at Casey Stoner right ahead, and then he needed to clear at least one more Honda, likely. Marco Melandri, probably, of Gresini. Fabio will not have that Yamaha support in Valencia. He will not have riders to make Bastianini's life hard, and there will not be a points-as-they-run situation, almost certainly, where Fabio is on course to be champion. Bagnaia will either crash out or not. That's basically it. The good news for Fabio is if Bagnaia crashes, then he'll be... I mean, depending on the crash, obviously, but he will be a lot less likely to make it back into the points than it was the case for Rossi in 2006. Because it's just a different MotoGP.
Yeah, it's tighter.
Yeah, it's just so much tighter. Yeah, it's exactly that. And the bikes don't spend the race like failing. You don't have some weird development Ilmor running at the back of the grid and finishing 20 laps down.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. So, but it's such a different world. And again, that support will not be there for Fabio. Honestly, Bagnaia will find himself in the Hayden position. Hayden after the crash, let Ducati have the 1-2, just cruise to where you need to be. It's harder to cruise in modern MotoGP, clearly is, but he can. I think he can, because he's just, the baseline pace is so good.
I actually weirdly think that if there's one weekend where there can be Yamaha support for Quartararo, bizarrely, all season, it might actually be this one. Because for the first time all season long, Franco Morbidelli is actually kind of getting into a little bit of form. He would have been with Quartararo last weekend if it wasn't for those long lap penalties at the end. And he goes really well at Valencia, which is quite bizarre, actually. It's weird that it's kind of come to this point where this might actually be the one road where he can do anything at all. I'm not sure what anything consists of. I mean, because the flip side of that is that if there's one person in the world that you wouldn't want to be up against whenever you need teammate support from Franco Morbidelli, it's probably Pecco Bagnaia. Because the VR46 Academy thing, like, does the VR46 Academy thing trump Yamaha teammate status?
Yeah.
It's a difficult question, but there's an argument that it might. So it's like the worst possible storm for actually finally, you know, having a teammate that could help him.
It's not an aggressive question, but ask Jarvis that.
But it's too hypothetical before Saturday. Like, because of going by the form of Morbidelli and stuff, from his form, honestly, the only way I can see, and this is really far-fetched, but the only way I can see him being a meaningful role where he is between Quartararo and Bagnaia is if his weekend sucks. If he sucks and if the RNF Yamaha suck, then it might matter in case Bagnaia falls off and rejoins 18th and needs to clear them for the final point spot. Because ultimately, if Morbidelli is really good and he's running 6th or something, and even if Fabio is somehow leading, if Morbidelli has any impact on where Bagnaia is right behind him, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's a hypothetical question for if Quartararo has to win and Bagnaia has to finish worse than 2nd.
Yeah.
Then maybe it's a hypothetical question that's actually worth asking. But as it is, yeah, I'm not sure what anyone can do apart from, you know, the only person who can help Fabio win the championship now is Pecco.
I mean, let's get the elephant out of the room here. They could knock him off, but they're not going to. Nobody's going to do it, so.
Oh, darn.
I mean, Darren Binder has a reputation.
I mean, Morbidelli has been aggressive as of late. And he's, you know,
can you imagine the war in the press office when that happens? There'll be fisticuffs. it would not be pretty.
It would not work. Mm. It would not be a thing. So, yeah.
I mean, it has been a thing in the past. As the FIM MotoGP safety officer, Lars Caparossi, can evidence, you know, people have knocked people off, made aggressive contacts to help ensure titles. And obviously in F1, it's also a thing as well.
We got 2 Caparossi Harada callbacks into one episode.
How impressive is that?
Very impressive, yeah.
Yeah. The difference with Jerez 97 for Formula 1 was that Schumacher went to a tribunal and he got his points removed for the whole season and it was there and then. The difference with Caparossi and Harada, Argentina, Buenos Aires, 98, 250, same team. I was there that day. Dennis was on my right-hand side, Dennis Noyes, and he went, it's a racing incident. And I went, if Harada wasn't there, Loris would be at the airport by now. He was not going to make the corner. He used him as a bomb. And we had one of those, and as a broadcaster, you never want this, very uncomfortable, live on air, arguments. And he was absolutely set over here. I was absolutely set over there. And we still don't agree, by the way, 20 something years later. But look it up. 250cc, Argentine Grand Prix, 98. Caparossi, just Google that. There was no chance at all. Harada got back to the pits and all the mechanics had destroyed the place. In the same team that had just won the championship. I mean, it was a complete mess.
Didn't Caparossi also have a contract with them for next year that they then tore up as a result of what he did? And he took them to court, sued them for breach of contract, won, and used the winnings to buy a white Ferrari with a lumber plate that said Aprilia, just to get back at them.
I didn't know about the Ferrari story, yeah. But, And then he had the number one plate on a 250 Gresini Honda, red, white, and blue thing.
And just to add like a little bit of context to bring this up to date, whenever we talk about the sort of character that Enea Bastianini's manager Carlo Pernat is, he was the guy managing Loris Caporossi at this time.
Oh dear, yeah.
Should say that when I say knock off, I don't mean like deliberately crash into the back of. I mean, do your typical elbows out, I'm taking the corner and I don't really care where you go type of move that sometimes will send the other person into the runoff, into the gravel, whatever. Which Franco Morbidelli will never deliberately take out anybody. He's a gent.
He's
a great guy. And Yamaha will not be interested in winning anything that way. No. Let's just get that out of the way. Like, obviously not. But Franco Morbidelli is an aggressive rider who has...
Especially of late.
Yeah, who's angered quite a few people with his antics on track as of late. Yes.
The battle for third in the championship is much, much tighter than the battle for the championship. Aleix Espargaró leads Enea Bastianini by just a single point after 212 points have gone to the Aprilia rider so far in 2022. So there's quite a bit up for grabs between those two. It might not mean much in the outside world. Hey, third position in the MotoGP Championship, but it will to their bank balances and their managers and their sponsors. So there's quite a battle there. The question is, Bastianini's on the Ducati. They've got the rub of the green at the moment, and it seems that Val Aprilia don't.
Yeah, also, I think the question is, will Aprilia run the red livery they sometimes do in Valencia? Because if they do, Bastianini might get confused. It's a factory Ducati, can't race it.
Oh, very good, what very good.
But then everyone knows the curse of the special livery.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, Bastianini did really well with the gorgeous special Gresini livery in, was it Misano?
This is true.
In any case, I only see this going one way, if I'm being honest. Assuming both riders stay on the bike, which is a big if, but assuming both riders stay on the bike, Enea Bastianini has more pace right now. The Ducati of 21 has more pace right now in his hands than Aleix's Aprilia has in his hands. And I only see it going one way. I see that third place in Bastianini's hands at the end of the... At the end, which will eliminate something of a headache, because if Bastianini somehow narrowly loses out to Aleix, he can go to Ducati and say, look, I took it easy on your boy at several parts this season, sort of. Can I still have the bonus? That's what I would do.
So that's what Carlo Pernat should do,
I think. Yeah.
I see it a little bit more open than you, Val, simply because Aprilia seemed to have a very strong internal belief that all the problems of late have been a result of being on flyaway races, of having basically zero data with this new bike that they're on, and that's kind of, you know, what's caused all of the woes that they've suffered in the last few races. And Valencia is obviously somewhere that they know quite well, somewhere that they've tested with this bike, somewhere that's a bit more familiar. So I think it's an important weekend for them, because it should hopefully kind of let them know one way or another if they had a second half of the season slump, or if they had a flyaway slump. And you know, in theory, like when you look at track layout, it should suit the Aprilia better if they're, you know, if things work. But then it's MotoGP, and what bike suits what track anymore anyway. So, you know, but yeah, I think it's a little bit more open than you do.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean. But honestly, even My take on it is, even taking into account that Aprilia probably will not be as bad as it's been as of late, just, and it has been good. It's been really good.
One other battle is the very embarrassing battle in the Constructors' Championship. Six constructors in MotoGP at the moment. Ducati run away with that from Aprilia in second. Yamaha, they're only 5 points back, so there's a little bit of squabbling to do there, but Honda at the moment are sixth out of six. There is a glimmer of hope that they could get fifth with Suzuki in front of them. But, oh dear, That kind of comes full circle to the banter that happened between Repsol Honda's Twitter and Grassini's Twitter during the week. You know, one more race to go, and Grassini went, "Are you looking forward to it?" Something like that. Bit of banter. What did Honda reply? "What are you going to order for Sunday? Are you going to get your orders in?" And Grassini said, "Yeah, the pizza."
Yeah.
First place.
That is a surprisingly fairly unprompted. I don't know how I feel about that one, because it was really mean. It was genuinely really just mean. It was funny, but actively mean. But it is better than the toned down 10 steps of PR approval, quote unquote, banter F1 teams do on Twitter. So, you know, just a note to people who want F1 to be at the level of MotoGP, the other way around, MotoGP to be at the level of F1 in terms of popularity. We all want that, and that will be cool. But a certain level of corporate sanitization, even more so than exists already, will come in, and there will be a lot of things that just suck. And yeah,
it's kind of off topic from the Constructors' Championship race, but MotoGP Twitter has been quite good fun this week, actually, because Pramac also found a photograph of the Grassini bike wearing sort of half unveiled from the team launch, and decided to post it from their own social media accounts saying, "Hey, look, it's Halloween, your bike gets to wear its cape now." and Grassini, without missing a beat, came straight back and were like, "We will take whatever publicity you want to give us. Thank you very much, our sponsors appreciate it." they've kind of woken up and not been shy of late.
Fair play.
You described the battle for last as embarrassing, Toby. I think it's only embarrassing for one of the two teams that are fighting for it. This is Suzuki's last race. They've had a torrid season. Their star rider has been injured. Their second rider has been wiped out of races. But Honda have no excuse, really, for being...
I only meant it one way, and I only meant it one way. Yeah. But, yeah, it's a mess.
I made a real big-time grimace when Simon wound up to describe Alex Rins as the number two rider in Suzuki. I don't know.
I mean, I'm going off 2020. I'm going off 2020.
Fair enough. Suzuki's another problem, I think, for Fabio, because that bike goes well in Valencia, usually. So... even if the Ducatis somehow all get, again, mass food poisoning en route there, the Suzukis might stop him from winning anyway and make the whole point irrelevant. And yeah, it's not embarrassing. Suzuki's not had a good season, but it would not be embarrassing to finish last. They have two bikes, and they've had an injured rider. They've done what they could with the budget that they have and with the news that they got. Honda, I mean, nothing that will happen in Valencia will change the fact that the RC213V is the worst bike on the grid this season. Mark has been doing... imagine no Mark. Imagine if Mark decided to sit out the rest of 2020. What would the constructor standings look like then? Horrifying, mortifying, awful. I think they will be last. I don't see a win with Suzuki non-scoring. But it's just, you know, just another kick in a season full of them. Except... You have Mark, and you can always think you have Mark, and that'll make it okay in the long term.
And just to go back to Suzuki being bad news for Quartararo, if Juan Mir didn't want to win before Alex Rins won in Phillip Island, he sure as hell does now.
Yeah, quite. Quick mention, because I wasn't here last week, but John McPhee winning that Malaysian Moto3 race, what was he, 22nd on the grid? Just friend of this podcast, friend of this commentary box, as I used to say, all round top bloke. We do have a little bit of bias. There are our cards absolutely being shown. But
I have absolutely no bias.
Okay, then. All right.
I'm Mr. Partial over here.
But just fantastic. Just fantastic. So, yeah. Have you seen him since, Simon?
Yes, I have indeed. He's kind of finally come down off the buzz. I think the buzz probably lasted a bit less than a normal post-race buzz would, by the fact that there's one race left in the championship and he's still got nothing signed for next year. But
That'll work out. That'll work out with a bit of luck. That'll work out. Other news. Article on the-race.com about the potential of a safety car being brought in case there are incidents during the race. One thing that was tried in about
1999. I was reminded of this.
03, 04.
Okay.
It was at Grand Prix Zero, which was the name that I gave to that pre-season test
in Catalonia
that would be at Barcelona or Jerez, maybe somewhere else we went. I can't remember. I think it was one of those two places. Anyway, we were at Barcelona 1 year, and they did a race. So all the bikes were out on track, and then the BMW would come in and do this and do that and do it, and it just didn't quite work out. But that was a lot. That was 20 years ago now. 20 years ago.
I had no recollection of that until Stuart Higgs, BSB race director, reminded me of it when I was chatting to him for the article that you're talking about. He said it was designed as an alternative to flag to flag. It was something designed for wet races to dry or vice versa.
Ah, yeah, you're right. And then they would all come in and then they'd all go out again. Yeah, I was halfway there, but it didn't work. It just didn't work, and there was a bit of pushback from the riders.
Yeah, but BSB have been using it really successfully for 20 years, and always the opposition to it that I've picked up in the GP paddock has been, the tyres wouldn't manage it. And I have to admit, I went and spoke to Mitchell, and I was really surprised when they were like, oh yeah, give us a year and we can make it happen. That actually came as a bit of a shock to me, without any performance drop as well. So, you know, given some of the things we've seen recently, maybe something to consider.
Mm. Yeah, it's an effective way to work within TV schedules and whatnot. The restart is always, even the quick restart procedure, it's still
15, 20 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's less than ideal, and it creates the incentive not to red flag. Like, even, you know, outside of the specific criticisms of how the current regime does things, it's just it makes you more reluctant to stop races. You know, I don't think we'd mind the field bunched up if they were single file. Starts are a bit dangerous. You wouldn't want too many starts in a race, but if you could have them single file, if you could have them maintain tire temperature, I don't know as to the exact mechanics. I don't know how fast they would have to go under the safety car to make that really viable. Whether they need like a prep lap at increased pace. I don't know. It's certainly worth looking into. I would. It makes sense.
The let's just throw it out there that the risk of restarts probably isn't a huge factor in the decision making in a championship that doubled the number of restarts for next season without consulting the riders.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And whatever happens with, say, a safety car during a race or whatever, there's two things to say. A, if there's a danger to an injured rider on the side of the track, then you just stop the race. I don't care for TV schedules. Secondly, you need a faster car than an M5. MotoGP bikes go around Silverstone, give or take 2 minutes. I'll bet you with the best touring car driver in the world behind an M5 CS Super Duper, it's 2.5 minutes. It's you need something a lot quicker.
I don't think it's that slow, but maybe I'd have to look into it.
You'd be surprised.
The problem is you can't get Marco Wittmann, the BMW DTM champion, to go do safety car moonlighting for MotoGP. I think that would be a tough ask, probably.
It won't be difficult to find a driver. It needs almost a prototype or something. But another day.
Hi, it's Nick from Minnesota. Every time there's a MotoGP wet race, it seems that the consensus is this is too dangerous. Should MotoGP invest in track drying equipment, or should MotoGP just quit trying to run races in the wet in the first place? Thanks.
Thanks, Nick. Interesting question with the thought of having track drying equipment a la kind of oval stuff with their jet blowers, as long as Montoya doesn't drive into the back of them. Specialist comment there. Does it seem that wet races are held for longer than the old days? I'll go with yes.
I don't think the problem is necessarily that we're not good at racing in the wet anymore. I think that the problem is more inherently in the calendar. It's the fact that we're going to Southeast Asia at a time of the year where they get extreme rain and extreme weather. And more than anything else, that's the factor. Because when you look at the races this year that ran successfully in the rain, places like Motegi, where it was a sort of a Motegi-esque amount of rain, it wasn't, you know, particularly unseasonable compared to Buriram or, you know, some of the Sepang weather that comes in. That's a different story because it's nothing to do necessarily with the amount of, or with the rain. It's just the sheer volume of it. It's that, you know, huge dumps that you get. And then that's the seasonal thing. It's because we're going as the seasons are changing and as it's sort of borderline monsoons time there. I've also got a theory, though, that it's actually something that's got worse in the last few years because of Michelin. Because Michelin might like to make a big deal about how the rear tires can pump something like 30 litres a second of water the rear tire can pump out. And So it makes sense that as you displace, but it makes sense that as the wet tires get better, and the Michelin wet tires are frankly phenomenal when you listen to the riders, it makes sense that they're going to put more water into the air spray behind. And more why we're saying races stopped in the rain is because of visibility issues.
I don't think we're in a bad position in terms of wet races. We're like significantly worse than other motorsport championships. I think we're okay. The biggest, in terms of risk, I mean, yeah, we have race postponements, race delays, but that's just part of the modern world. We're a bit more careful with safety now. Ultimately, motorcycle racing's biggest fatality concern right now is definitely not rain. It's running in the pack and having other bikes hit you when you fall. As Simon alluded to, the Michelin wets, I mean, yeah, the visibility issue is there, but when Moto2 riders show up to MotoGP and they try the Michelin wets for the first time, they go, this is incredible. I love these so much. They have so much grip, which helps them stay on. We've not seen huge injuries as of late in the wet. I mean, the one that my brain always goes to is Tika Rabat at Silverstone in whatever year when the whole thing shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, and that was, we can lay the blame for that on the Asphalt and Company.
Yes, exactly. So it's
But likewise, Val, there's no skill in falling off. Once you fall off, you're in the hands of the gods.
Yeah. But there's frequency as much, like more than the falls in the wet are severe. The bike chucks you off into space. Yeah, that's a problem. That's part of a safety concern. But I don't think it's been like terrible or anything. And there's never been a moment in MotoGP where I was like, why aren't you running? The track is dry enough. Like the tracks I've seen, I've been like, yeah, okay, hang on there. Maybe rethink again, as Simon says, maybe think about the calendar. But in terms of what they actually do and how the wet races work out and all that, I think we're good. I think we're in a good place.
Yeah. But it can rain in June, it can rain in July.
Yeah, obviously.
I've been at Mugello in June and it's been stair rods. We were at Silverstone at the end of the August when we had that wet year, and yet an August bank holiday in the UK can be boiling hot. It can rain at any day.
If it rains too much, you don't race. That's fine. That's just an answer that we have to accept as the viewing public, I think.
Yeah, I think the most dangerous rain situation I can think of since that Silverstone one was Portimao this year with the Moto2 race, where they hit a shower of rain on a section of the track and like the top 10 went down. And arguably, while there were obviously extenuating circumstances in both of those, part of the problem was also, I think, a lack of direction from race control. Like especially the Silverstone one with Rabat, that should have been stopped before it got to the stage it got to. Which maybe potentially brings us back to the safety car thing and being a bit more, why we need to be a bit more flexible with, you know, with not adhering to a rigid race schedule and being afraid to stop or slow or whatever it is a race.
We'll start early.
So we don't have like rain messages on the dash, do we?
No.
So that feels like a fairly easy fix to me.
Yeah.
Rain flags, turn, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like a full fix, but it's a good start. Otherwise, just hoping and praying that the rider notices a rain flag that comes out in time moments before he hits a wet patch and goes into space. But it's again, that's a different problem.
Yeah.
I think it's a problem, but it's a different one, and it doesn't speak to the overall danger of wet races, which again, I think MotoGP is in a good place. And just one more thing, Nick from Minnesota. The Vikings have been really good this year, haven't they? Like, I'm not much of a Kirk Cousins believer, but they've been much better than the Packers. Very impressed.
Meanwhile, back on planet Earth, what is the forecast for this weekend in Valencia, not Minnesota?
It looks pretty good. I'm a little bit up the coast in the mountains at the minute, and it's absolutely glorious. I know some people who've been in Girona this week, which is a little bit further up the coast from Valencia, and it's been glorious. And the forecast looks okay, so I think we're going to get lucky. It is worth noting that we're like 3 weeks earlier than we have been at some previous years at Valencia, and than we will be next year. This week's, I think race day is the 6th of June or 6th of November off the top of my head. I think next year's is the 26th. And we start in Portimao in March. So speaking of calendars that don't make much sense for weather, there's your examples.
There's a lot to do. Anyway, thank you, Nick, for your question. Do send your voice notes into podcasts@the-race.com. The email there, podcasts@the-race.com. And we will go through your voice messages, and then we will have a great conversation starter, thanks to you guys. And then you will be in one of our podcasts. Well, it's been a long time since we kicked the ball off in Qatar. We will have to go back and listen to our season preview, gentlemen, and see who we picked. And then we will bring that up in next week's podcast after the Valencian Grand Prix, when we find out who is the 2022 MotoGP World Champion.
Val already looks smug.
No, I don't. I don't remember. It's not smug.
I seem to recall a Bastianini prediction that's...
All right. Well, yeah, I've been tooting the Bastianini horn for a while there. So that's... At least I have that one. I bet the rest is absolute trash from my end, but at least I have this one.
Yeah. Anyway, it looks to be a good one. So wherever you will be watching from, wherever in the world, then make sure you tune into this weekend, and make sure you download our podcast after this Valencian Grand Prix. In the meantime, keep in touch with the-race.com for all the stories from Simon and Val, together with all the Formula One stories as well. In the meantime, we look forward to the race this weekend. Speak to you after Valencia. Bye for now.
The Athletic.